If you're ready, I'm ready.
Anytime
you feel like you need to stop, just let us know.
Okay.
Day is August 7, 2007. I'm Dr. Reginald Carter, and I'm interviewing Shelley. Would you give your name?
I'm Shelley Hicks. I am Senior Manager of Conference Education currently.
Right. Shelley, let's start with talking about your formative years, growing up, and what that was like, and where you went to school, and kind of the experience you had before getting to the academy.
Well, I was born in Danville, Illinois, but as an Army brat, I lived all over the world. I have three sisters who were all close by. We're all very close. I think that's kind of forced by being an Army brat. I went to high school in the Northern Virginia area. So this is really home. I probably have lived here longest of any place in my tenure. I went to school at Virginia Tech. I have an undergraduate degree in education. And it started out teaching school initially at a parochial school here in Falls Church. I taught health and physical education to K through 8. It was great fun, but you certainly can't make a living doing that. Certainly not in this area. I then decided to take a job with a government contractor here. I did administrative work in their accounting department and went back to graduate school. Got a master's degree in school counseling from George Washington University. I kind of joke about that because while I don't do school counseling, I counsel every day, whether it's with staff members or with speakers or whoever. So, when I came to the academy, it was kind of an unusual circumstance. Marilyn, who is my sister, had come to the academy working for the exec, and she knew that they needed help cleaning up CME files. And I was miserable working where I was. And I just decided that I was going to quit and find a job. And she said, well, in the meantime, until you find what you want, they need help, and you can do it. It's not that difficult. So that's what I started out doing, was cleaning up CME records and membership records. And at that time, it seemed like PAs moved every other week. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that wasn't the case. It just felt that way. So we were doing a lot of that kind of thing, a lot of administrative cleaning up files, keeping records current, that kind of thing. So
you started out as a part-time job?
I did. I started out part-time in January of 1978, mm-hmm. doing just about anything they needed done, which was fine because it
made it easy. And Don Fisher
That's
was
correct.
There. And how long had Marilyn been here when you came?
I'm not certain how long. I think Marilyn had probably been here 6 or 8 months. I think she started in 77 because she just had her anniversary, her 30th anniversary.
And you were at Crystal City.
We were in Crystal City in a little teeny tiny office. I can actually visualize it in my head. You know, you walk in the door, turn right. And so it was a small office, about 12 or 15 people. I remember the day that Bob Johnston came to interview. Because he came, I guess, March of 2000 of 78, a couple months after I had started temping there.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long did the temp job go before you decided?
Well, actually, right after the annual conference, as I recall, Joy O'Connor, who was working in the meetings department behind for Jim Bartow at the time. Mm-hmm. Decided to go on to other things, and because I knew how to use the IBM Mag card and this big fancy laser printer and everything, it was sort of, you know, by default, will you fill in for her? And so it was February of 79 when I officially went on the books as a full-time employee of the Academy.
And that was conference planning primarily?
It was primarily that, but you know, in those days, we did lots of things. I cleaned up membership records in CME and the meeting planning things. Of course, the meeting was so small that, or in comparison to what it is today, it was small at the time.
So what was your first conference that you remember?
The first conference that I went to was 1979 in Hollywood, Florida.
Oh, yes.
I remember standing in water because of the hurricane.
Right.
I stood in water at the registration desk because they had, it was gushing in the windows, and I was just, there were some interesting stories at that meeting, but.
16 inches of rain in 2 days, as I recall.
It was horrible.
So that was your introduction to conferencing for PAs.
It was, and it was really my first exposure to PAs other than leadership, mm-hmm. which was a nice experience.
When you came over, it was just a job, but did you have any idea of what a PA was, what a physician assistant?
I did, sort of. I mean, I'm not sure that I totally understood the profession at the time. I had some sense because when Marilyn took the job, we were all interested, of course. And being an Army brat, we were seen by corpsmen frequently as the first step before we, you know, if you went to sick call, the likelihood was that you saw a corpsman. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't a stretch for us, I don't think, to understand the role that PAs were filling. Mm-hmm. And but I have learned so much over the years. I kind of joke about how, you know, how they say a little bit of knowledge can be very dangerous. Well, there are times that I feel that way.
How did your role change? You started out kind of as a cleanup person, and then you started out with a conference plan with Jim Bartow. And where did you go from there? I know the conference planning eventually moved.
It did. That became my primary role. And when I took over more of the responsibility for the educational portion of the meeting, and Jim did most of the logistics up until, I guess, about 1980.
So you were putting together the CME and getting the lectures and those kinds of people. Mm-hmm.
So in 1980, at the annual meeting here in Washington, the board decided, Jim was a consultant, if you will. He was not an employee of the Academy, and they opted to come in-house, which was very flattering to me to think they thought that I could do it. So it was a learning experience naturally for me, but I felt like I could do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not risk averse or afraid of many things, and I'm willing to learn on the job. So,
who were the PAs involved at that time in CME development and those things? You remember?
My first committee chair, as I recall, was Barry Bushman. Mm-hmm. It was at UT Southwestern, or it was University of Texas, Dallas at the time. Mm-hmm. He was my first chair, and the committees were very different at that time because there was a chair, but the bulk of the committee members were leaders of the Academy, president, president-elect, frequently a member of the APAP faculty, or the APAP board was part of that planning group, and that was the core of the education planning. Were those PAs who served in those roles.
Did they just know physicians and PAs who would lecture or had lectured in programs?
I think that that was how it started. Mm-hmm. I think that, or people that they had heard lecture. Mm-hmm. We were also very fortunate at that time, things were different in that industry was very involved with us. Mm-hmm. Letterly Laboratories at the time did a full day.
And sponsor lectures.
And while they identified lecturers, it was to our benefit because they knew the best and the brightest. They knew who was doing research. I'm sure it wasn't a disinterested suggestion, but at the same time, I do think that the education that was provided was pretty good quality. Mm-hmm. And Pfizer Dialogue Series was the same way. They had a series of lectures that they did. Interesting how that kind of evolved. That evolved from WFP. And what they did was they had faculty that they used at WFP to do lectures, and then took a look at, they did many more than they did at our meeting, but they took a look at those and said, well, these would be perfect for PAs. And that was sort of how our program, the Pfizer Dialogue program, was built. So that was really 2 days of the meeting. Was taken up by that, because we went from when I went back through the files just to see, and I'm always amazed when I look at that. We went from 32 hours and 88 exhibits in Hollywood, Florida in 1979 to over 400 hours of CME and 540 exhibits in 2005 in Orlando, which was the largest for those two things at the time. So, and attendance grew from, we had 1,955 in 79, and then in 2004, which was our highest because it was in Vegas, was 10,800. So it's, when you look back at the numbers, it's incredible when you think about the growth.
How were you logging CME and keeping up with that in the early days?
I have nightmares about that sometimes. We had a company called Aztec that was, I guess, I don't even know what you called them, computer processing. Found out, we filled out little pieces of paper, and we filled in the bubbles. So when there were cards, they were sort of manila colored, and there were five categories of CME. I don't know if you remember that. There were five different categories of CME. You could only have a certain number in each one. And it was about the size of a number 10 envelope, and they would come in a little teeny tiny print. I'd need a magnifying glass now. And you would go through and you would review all those, and you would fill out a form, a half sheet form with the bubbles in the various categories. That would be sent out to Aztec to put into a database. So we didn't have that.
So did the PA themselves fill in the bubble?
No, or staff filled in the bubble.
Staff in the bubble, okay.
They actually sent, PA sent a card with whatever, with the dates and how many hours and what it was they
what
attended.
Category. Mm-hmm.
And
y'all had to put it on the bubbles to
on
the
bubble
the
forms
computer.
To go to the computer. Mm-hmm. So times have changed a whole lot.
How did you record CME, and who took that at the meetings? Was there...
That was self-declared, as it is now. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's one of the things I really like about the profession is the feeling of responsibility and allowing PAs the opportunity to take responsibility for their own education. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, my theory has always been you're only shortchanging yourself if you're lying on your CME forms. And I truly do not believe that PAs do that. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, there's so much opportunity for CME and learning available at no cost or at low cost and one of the most exciting things about this profession is that, and we hear that from speakers, we hear that from exhibitors, that PAs are a great audience because they're hungry to learn. Mm-hmm. You know, they are willing to listen and ask questions, intelligent questions. They're not just waiting for you to put a funnel in their mouth and dump this load in, kind of thing. So people filled out a form. As I recall, in 78, it was a full sheet, and people listed the number of the session they went to, and that was how it was done.
Looking over the almost 30 years
now. Yeah, scary.
How has your role changed in the Academy over time?
Actually, I've gone from support role to, at one point, I managed the entire conference, and the conference scope has gotten so broad that we've subdivided it, specialized, if you will, just like other professions have done. And my responsibility now is entirely the educational program. Deal with about 350 to 400 speakers a year. And hard to believe, but it takes almost an entire year to do that.
Right.
Between the planning phase. The Conference Education Program Committee is under my purview. There are 11 folks who practice and are also faculty members in many cases.
Are y'all approving the CME that people give at the constituent level?
I'm not. That goes strictly to, in the Membership Services Department, Adrienne Harris, who does that, has a history. She used to work for, I think, radiology. I don't know if it was American College of Radiology. At any rate, she has a good, firm background in the ACME standards, and we follow the same guidelines. And interestingly enough, many times she'll say to me, if you say it's CME, because you did that for so long. And I said, I want somebody else to look at it, because it's so hard. When it's just like proofreading your own stuff. You know, it's not necessarily a good idea, because you see what you want to see. So,
what's been the most challenging thing in your role with the Academy as far as over time, just things that you had to
face? I think over time, it's probably not much different than any other profession in that when you have limited resources, plenty of work, limited time or limited resources to do it, and you just overcome those, you know, you just find a way to muddle through and somehow come out on the other end and hope that you've crossed all your T's, dotted all your I's, done what needs to be done, but that's probably it. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, I have not experienced any major challenges with the pharmaceutical industry or organized mm-hmm. medicine. Mm-hmm. The profession has such a good reputation built over time that, you know, they're always happy to see mm-hmm. us coming, or that's been my experience anyway. And I think it's a nice, flattering thing to say about the profession. We have speakers, big-time speakers, who come to the meeting, and after they've experienced it one time, they're anxious to come back, mm-hmm. whether or not we can pay them what many other groups pay them. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem to be the issue, which says a lot about the profession, I think. Mm-hmm.
Looking at challenges, we can flip it to the other side. Looking at your own role and what you've been involved in, are there some things that just stand out in your mind of saying, gee, yeah, that was really great that we accomplished that or did that?
I think just the fact that we've grown so exponentially mm-hmm. and being able to offer a lot of alternatives. Mm-hmm. We are hands-on workshops at the annual conference. While they're expensive and rarely do they ever break even. Mm. It's they're great learning experiences, and I think those who attend them, who take the time and spend the money to do so, really gain a lot from that. The other thing is the fact that we've gone all electronic. Mm-hmm. Used to be slides and overheads and all. Well, there's not a slide projector to be found or an overhead to be found. Mm-hmm. I take that back. I think one workshop we had an overhead. Because now it's all done electronically, it's all sent to a server, the server then sends it to the appropriate room at the appropriate time. And I think initially speakers kind of were frightened by that, mm-hmm. because it was sort of a loss of control, I think, they mm-hmm. felt. Mm-hmm. And once they'd experienced it, they loved it, because it gave them the opportunity to make changes literally right up until mm-hmm. minutes before they walk out the door of the ready room to the mm-hmm. to the lecture. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, was a great accomplishment for us. Mm-hmm. Getting rid of paper handouts, which we haven't done entirely. Going green is a struggle mm-hmm. every step of the way, because I'm the same way. I like to have a piece of paper in my hand. Mm-hmm. But that's, we're moving in that direction. Those things stick out in my mind mm-hmm. as big and good things that have happened at the annual conference.
Looking at the profession over these years, how have you seen, what have been the biggest challenges, you think, in the profession itself? Not the Academy staff, but looking at
right.
the profession, what's been the biggest things to overcome?
I think that proving their value mm-hmm. to organized medicine first was a true challenge. And I think they've overcome that. Mm-hmm. I think organized medicine recrecognizes that PAs are players and belong at the table. I think that... I think there's still a little of this going on. I think that some people struggle with how they prove that the education provided to PAs is truly master's level education. And convincing those, for example, nurses who, well, you know, it doesn't have this, doesn't have this. I think that that's been a challenge. And I think that the challenge has been met. The fact that we've gone from mostly certificate programs to mostly master's programs, and a recognition of the quality of the education, and I think the fact that medicine is taking a look at the way PA education, just exactly like Dr. Stead said. You know, if you take a look at it, and if you get away from this box you put yourself in and realize that if you make it more hands-on, more less fanny in a seat, if you will, kind of thing, that you'll recognize that you can speed the process. And I think that's an impressive thing, to think that medicine is finally recognizing the value of the way PA education is conducted. So it's been a challenge, but I think that the challenge has been met and that good things are coming from that.
Projecting, I mean, it's hard to tell about the future, but where do you see the future for PAs? What kinds of things there? If you look into the future, would you say PAs?
I actually think there will be more PAs in administrative roles. It's hard to say. But I do think that they have a good perspective because most have done clinical work. There may be more PAs doing research, doing clinical research, which is a good thing. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see what has happened to many other professions where you've got the credential creep and all these other things. I don't want to see that happen. And I think that PAs are grounded enough and care about doing patient care enough that even as administrators, there will be some... I just think that the focus is different. You know, they're looking more at the patient than at the system, not to the exclusion of the system necessarily, but more inclusive of care.
Staying with the basics.
You got it.
You've been around and seen the leadership development within the academy. And again, I'm talking about the PAs here. Is there any particular people or groups of people that stand out in mind?
You know, it's funny. I started thinking when I was at Leadership Summit last weekend and looking around the room, and there were faces coming back again. PAs who'd been leaders before and had either stayed as leaders or had gone off and done their thing, had families worked and decided they wanted to come back into leadership. Names that stick out in my mind, although they're not all still active. Scott Chavez. Bruce, of course. Bruce is never going to go away. That's okay. Judy Willis, because she was the first woman president of the Academy and actually was a staff member for a while.
That's right.
Bill Kohlhepp, who had been a student president and then came back and the Speaker of the House was president and then has served as a liaison for things. Sherry Stewart had been in the House and then a president and then came back as a council chair and member. Rick Roars, who had been my committee chair for a number of years, was active in the commission leadership and then was president and just recently left the board. Those people stick out.
Yeah. People who've been involved in all the different organizations at one time or another. Yeah.
It's funny because I think when I think of APAP or PAEA, I think of you. I think of Elaine Grant, Ruth Baldwick, Walter Stein, and I don't know whatever happened to Walter, but you know, there are just some people that you think of having been active in leadership and have stayed somewhat active in the profession even after that.
Well, we've been blessed with good leadership, and it'd be impossible to name everybody.
I think so.
So it's played roles. Within the academy itself, looking at members of the staff, any particular people? I know there have been some been around longer than others, but and vice presidents or executive directors?
Well, I think Lynn May was terrific. He was a different kind of boss, I think.
And he had the new building was part
of his. He did. He joined us when we were in Roslyn, and then we built the building, and then he was here when the expansion took place. And of course, all the, quote, we call ourselves dinosaurs, you know. Bob and Nicole, and we have some other dinosaurs too. We have, well, not dinosaurs like we are, but Johnny Smith. This he's our IT. He was the. This was his first job.
Oh.
Out of college.
I didn't realize that.
Oh yeah, and what's today? Today is. I'm trying to see my email message. I think it was 19th anniversary today.
Mm-hmm.
So. Mm-hmm. That's a sign of something, I guess. A good place to work.
I remember coming up and seeing the IT first time, and I think there was only one person really understood how anything worked, and it was a great big old computer, and took up a whole room.
It was probably Vince Grandy.
Yeah.
Or somebody. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
It is funny how, yeah, and it had to be freezing cold, and you know, how times have changed.
I'm sure there's things that we haven't touched on. There's mm-hmm. other recollections you have. Are there other things that stand out in your mind about the academy itself, or how things have changed over the years, or the profession?
It's amazing to think that it went from 12 or 15 people, and we're now over 80.
Mm-hmm.
And we have people at remote sites, you know, working from California and Michigan, Arizona. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I don't know. Were you at the 91 conference in Miami Beach?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I just remember that picture. There's one in the hallway. Have you seen it? With all the presidents all mm-hmm. decked out and everything. It was a lot of that sticks in my mind. No, I can't think of anything other than stories we wouldn't tell on tape ever to anyone.
The Academy has a reputation of being lean, clean, hardworking compared to other mm-hmm. associations. How does that make you feel? I know you talked about sometimes you felt limited because of resources and other things. But
actually, I'm proud to be able to say that we do a lot with the minimal staff, really.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the numbers are if you said, for example, some of the organized medicine groups where they have certain number of staff mm-hmm. members to their member ratio or whatever, but I would say that we do a lot
mm-hmm.
with a lean staff.
Mm-hmm. Unlike the AMA, the Academy has been able to keep everyone kind of under their umbrella so far and not splintered out, although we have specialty groups and things mm-hmm. like that. Do you perceive that as being something that's been easy, or you just see...
I think it's a challenge. It's, and you know, we all know the old adage, it's very hard to be everything to everybody, and mm-hmm. you can't please everybody all the time kind of thing. But it is true that I think the Academy makes a concerted effort to keep in mind that we represent everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Who graduates as a physician assistant, whether they're in academia or clinical medicine or ophthalmology or radiology or primary care, or whatever the case might be. And that's not an easy task. I think there will always be a place for constituent organizations whose primary focus is much narrower. But I do think it makes I think it increases our credibility with the federal mm-hmm. government, with the pharmaceutical industry,
mm-hmm.
with insurance industry.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that that's true, but I truly do believe that that is the case, that by speaking with one voice, it makes it much more credible.
Well, you'll be glad to know that Harvey Estes thinks that the AMA did themselves in when they cut out CME and just become a political body.
Whoa.
So being in CME, I'm sure you
That's very interesting.
That.
And, you know, CME is a target right now.
Yeah.
And I will agree, having been in it as long as I have, there are good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
But all you can do is try and provide a quality product and hope that people will see it as such. But that's an interesting perspective.
Again, 30 years of experience, and looking at the profession, it certainly has become more diverse since you've been around.
Interesting changes. The change from primarily male to primarily female to much younger first careers versus later years, second, third, fourth careers. I'm trying to think what other, and certainly more educated and more master's degrees and all those things. Yeah, a lot of changes. There is room for more diversity,
though. 3-1-3,
there is no doubt that there is room for diversity. And I remember when I worked as staff advisor to APAP, that was always a challenge. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you increase the number of diversity focuses? That, I mean, you can only do so much. Mm-hmm. And how do you encourage non-Caucasians to enter the profession? I mean, how do you make it attractive to African Americans and Asian Americans, whose cultures have always just said, you know, the doc is God. Mm-hmm. And there's just a sea change that needs to take place. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those have been rough years. I think as more minorities have minority role models and are seen mm-hmm. by PAs, I think that's probably the key there, and it's a matter of numbers. So hopefully the numbers will get there someday. I can't think of anything else to ask. If there's anything else you want to add to the rec, I'd be glad to.
That I can think of. Well, PAs have been fun too. I mean, that's an important thing. And as I say, it's nice to be able to work for a group where the educators who come and speak want to come back. You know, it makes my job so much easier. So.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate the
my pleasure.
Years that you've given to the Academy, and thank you for this interview.
My pleasure.